Welcome to a very special edition of the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you with me as I remember my friend, the late great singer-songwriter, environmentalist, and humanitarian, John Denver. Let's get to it. This is the one time of year that I both get excited and dread a little bit doing a show about John Denver, who passed away 23 years ago today, October 12th, 1997, in a plane crash off Monterey Beach, California. And if you've listened to any of my shows over the last 20 plus years, read any of my books, heard me do some speaking events and things like that, I will often refer to John as he was someone who was in my life, in some ways larger than life, but also someone who was right at the same level I was at and insisted that I find higher levels and higher ground in myself. And the stories of how we met over the years are many and varied, but to make it short and condensed for this particular podcast, it was in 1992 where I found myself in the basement of the Wang Center in Boston. It's a beautiful theater there. John was doing a concert for the Catholic Charities of Boston, and I was there on a whim, actually. I had really felt this intuitive push to go see him in Boston. Now, I already knew him a bit from attending the Windstar Choices for the Future symposiums over the year that were held in Aspen, Colorado, kind of a think tank, really, of a meeting of the minds and finding ways to live a more sustainable life and things to do with hunger in the world, you know, high priority, high level stuff. And I had been so moved by the efforts of Windstar that it was really a force for me. And so in 1992, I flew out to see John, and I had just started speaking to small groups of people, not really aware of what I was doing, quite frankly, but I felt inclined to at least make my points known. And in this particular case, I was talking to young kids at school, which is probably the best audience on the planet. And I flew out to Boston to see him, and after the concert there, we had about 10 minutes together, and I thought that he would know why I was there. I mean, I really didn't have any idea. I could have seen him a few weeks later in Chicago, but there was something about going to Boston that I needed to do. So I get there, we get behind the scenes, everybody else is cleared out, it's just he and I standing in the auditorium bowels, as it were, and shook hands and gave a hug and said, how you doing, and this and that. And after the pleasantries, he said, so what are you doing here? And I really thought he would know that they're like, he'd have another piece of the puzzle, the other part of the key of the lock. And I said, well, you know, I thought you would know. And he looked at me like, I don't know why you're here. Outside of saying hello and how you doing, which I could have, as I said, easily done a few weeks later in Chicago and drove to the theater instead of flying to Boston and back, which was a whole adventure in itself. And he said, did you bring me something? And as soon as he said that, I realized that I had some letters from those kids that I had spoken to a few times in my pocket, in my jacket pocket. Oh, yeah, I think I brought these for you. Not realizing that I was doing anything of any significance, but at least I had something to give him. And I gave him these letters, and he's standing there in front of me, and he's going through each letter, not saying a word. We're just standing there, the two of us. And he's going through each letter. Finally, when he's done, there's probably six or eight of these. These kids were not very prolific. They were all, half sheets of paper. But he looked up at me with this big grin. And when John smiled, especially close up, it was the same kind of smile you kind of got when, like the school bell rang early or something. You got out, like this big, broad grin. And he looked at me and he said, do you have any idea what you're doing here? I'm like, nope. He says, do you understand that your voice matters? Do you get that? Nope, I don't. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he looked me in the eye and he says, John, your voice matters. Don't forget that. And I know the coming years are going to prove me right by telling you this. And I felt like the clouds parted a little bit, not so much because it was him, but because a message was being delivered. The messenger was far less important at that moment than the message itself. And no one had ever asked me that, nor do I ever consider that really, that my voice could matter in any way, shape, or form outside of, yelling at somebody at a football game or whatever, low-level stuff. Not that there's anything wrong with football. I played it most of my life. But the point is, not at that level. And he says, at Windstar, we really should be doing more programs for kids this age. And he said, can I take these letters back with me to Aspen? And we have a meeting in a few weeks with the Windstar board, and I'd love for them to see what you've done here. Sure, like I planned it, right? But I hadn't. So he had to leave and go to do some PR thing. He said, take this stuff and put it in my bag. And it was one of those handshakes where we're shaking hands and going in the opposite directions. Your arm just keeps stretching and stretching, and we're promising to stay in touch and all that kind of stuff. And finally, we broke the grip and off he went. And I went into the dressing room. Nobody's there. Stuffed those letters in the envelope, went upstairs, and caught a cab in a snowstorm back to my hotel. Maybe a month, 2 months later, I get a phone call from the Windstar office in Snowmass, Colorado. And they said, Mr. Denver brought these letters to our meeting. And he was, really impressed with what you had accomplished. I didn't know that I'd accomplished anything, quite frankly, except taking some time to talk to a bunch of school kids. And we'd like to start thinking about implementing some educational programs for Windstar. So thanks for doing that. Great. So I felt vindicated, like the trip was worth it. There was something I had done that made sense. And how was I to know that 2 years later, in 1994, that Dr. Mae Jemison, the first female black astronaut in history, would cancel as a speaker at the 9th annual Choices for the Future Symposium, The Human Family. I had no way to know that was going to happen. And for sure, I didn't know that the next call I got would be from John saying, it's your turn. I'd like you to replace Dr. Jemison at the symposium. And at that time, I was still 3 years away from doing radio. I was at least 9 or 10 years from writing my first book. I had not gone out and spoken, which has become so much of a calling and a career for me in many places around the world. None of that had happened yet. And I thought, what does he want me to talk about? But the interesting, odd thing was that a year prior, before those phone calls, I was teaching part-time at my alma mater, Schurz High School, as a sub. And I was in there basically every day. There's 250 teachers. There's always about 20 or 30 absent. I was always working. So I had a mailbox there, and I had gotten a flyer for the Choices for the Future Symposium, The Human Family, a year prior to those phone calls. And it was the first time in my life when I saw the words human family that words came to me. And by the time I got home that day, I had written out an entire poem or song called The Human Family. It was really amazing. finished it up in the yard, and there I sat with it. So I had this thing for a whole year, not even knowing why. And then that call came from John. And in late September, I think it was like the last weekend in September of 1994, I found myself on the stage on a Saturday morning in front of 2,000 people, 2,500 people, whatever the Aspen Music Tent holds. And I had a talk that I had designed called The Ripple Effect with no notes. Zero notes, no scripts, no notes, no pointers, no overhead, nothing. It was just me and my intent to deliver the mail, as it were. And when I finished my talk about the ripple effect with the words to the human family, which is in the book Living an Uncommon Life, and it's also in my latest book, Phenomenon, it was a standing ovation, and something clicked, something switched, a rudder was bent in a certain direction, has never been the same since. So everything that I do, this podcast, the Bridge Radio Show, it's an international show that I do now, and all the other radio between, from starting with nothing in 97 to designing the Oprah Radio Network for satellite, to WGN, to CBS Overnight, to just a thousands of hours of that, plus all the talks I've done, two TED Talks, the books I've written, all that stuff, in my mind, comes from that meeting with John in the basement of the Wang Center after a concert, just two guys talking, and him asking me the question, do you know that your voice matters? And it took me a while to figure out that he saw something in me that I could not see in myself at that time. So this show, I do this every year, it never gets any easier. Matter of fact, I find myself strangely emotional, and I'm not exactly sure why. You know, it's one thing to have somebody pass away that's made an impact in your life. That's obvious. My parents are gone. I've had some great friends that have gone ahead of me. But as I've looked at it, why do I get so emotional about this day, besides the obvious? And I think what it comes down to is that there is a void that was created that I really can't fill, nor can anybody else. So while I used to kid John, you know, I can't sing like you, he would say, well, I can't write like you when we were even. But the point is that earth voice, that international presence that did so much for so many people around the world, that void has really never been filled. And I think that's what gives me the most pause emotionally, what a waste, what a shame. On the other hand, I also know that it was his time. I've come to couch that for myself. I believe for me that we come in on time and we leave on time. And what you do with that time in between, that's up to you. You could waste it, or you could build great things, or bemoan your fate and complain, or whatever. That's up to you. So as I realize that I have more yesterdays than tomorrows, I am far more adamant and focused on delivering the mail that's been given to me. And John has got a huge part to play in that. And, you know, I find the little connected dots so fascinating. I really didn't connect with his music until 1974. I was working at a Dunkin' Donuts restaurant. That's my first job. And my friend Michelle Milkovic was the first person I met there. We became fast friends. She was working the counter, and I was washing the floors in the toilets at 4:30 in the morning. And I eventually moved up to baker status. I was making all kind of donuts, man. And to this day, you know, get me a double chocolate and a grape knee-high, and I'm happy camper. But one time in 1974, on a warm summer evening, she said earlier in the day, why don't you come over tonight and I want you to listen to this record. And I think you're really going to like this guy's voice. Now, this was 1974. He had already had Country Roads. I kind of heard that. In 72, 73, Rocky Mountain High came out. I'd heard that. But this particular song, when she dropped the needle on Sweet Surrender, everything shifted for me.
Lost and alone on some forgotten highway, traveled by many, remembered by few. Looking for something that I can believe in, looking for something that I'd like to do with my life. There's nothing behind me and nothing that ties me to something that might have been true yesterday. Tomorrow is open, right now it seems to be more than just be here today. And I don't know what the future is holding in store. Don't know where I'm going. I'm not sure where I've been. There's a spirit that guides me, a light that shines for me. My life is worth living. I don't need to see the end. Sweet, sweet surrender. Live, live without care. Like a fish in the water. Looking for something that I can't believe in. Looking for something that I'd like to do with my life. There's nothing behind me and nothing that ties me to something that might have been true yesterday. Tomorrow is open. Right now it seems to be more than enough to just be here today. And I don't know what the future is holding in store. Don't know where I'm going. I'm not sure where I've been. There's a spirit that guides me, a light that shines for me. My life is worth the living. I don't need to see the end. Sweet, sweet surrender. Live, live without care. Like a fish in the water.
Over the years, I've had the opportunity and the real gift of getting to know Ron Dutchendorf, John's brother, since we first connected around his work at Windstar many, many years ago. And then I believe the last time we were in the same zip code was probably 2010. I was in Aspen for a book signing, and they had a big thing going on at Windstar that weekend, and I was able to split time between the book signing duties and run up to some just pristine sacred ground at the Windstar Foundation, and they were all out doing a bunch of work, and it was great to see him. Kind of a mini symposium, had to spend time with a lot of great folks there. And so even though I'd rather not do these interviews with Ron and just talk about things like baseball, football, and God knows what else, I always appreciate that he takes the time to connect and talk about John and the WinStar years and all the rest of it. Ron, welcome to the show. Glad to have you, pal.
Thanks, John. It's nice to be here. Nice to hear your voice again.
Yeah, man. You know, it's been way too long. You know, I say that every time, but the older I get, I realize that's really true. We get these long gaps in between when we see each other. I think it was 2010 was the last time you and I were in the same place.
I heard you saying that a second ago, and I'm thinking, has it been that long? It was 2010?
Yeah. Too long. Too long.
Can't believe it.
Yeah. So on the, you know, I've talked for years on all the radio platforms I've had, whether it was on Oprah Radio, I did a special that you were on with a bunch of other folks 10 years after John's death. And then everywhere I've gone, I've done something on the 12th and his birthday, the 31st of December, as a commemorative to this guy who was such an influence with me, his friendship, his support. You know, I've told you this before, and it always bears mentioning because I like to always give credit where credit is due. Had John not stuck me on the WinStar stage in 1994, I wouldn't be doing any of this. I'm convinced of that. So I'm indebted to him for seeing things in me long before I was writing books, before I was on the radio, before I ever thought doing a TED Talk. There was no such thing as TED Talks back then. So I'm so indebted to what he was able to see in me and help me bring out myself. And that's why WinStar is so near and dear to my heart. And it had a run for quite a while with the symposiums. It was a big deal. I was honored to be part of it. And then in the later years after John was gone, it became a bit more difficult. And I've always wondered, what was it that brought you to the table? I mean, you took the mantle of WinStar on when maybe you didn't have to, but what was the movement that got you there?
Well, it's funny you should ask. About 3 years after John's passing, a bunch of the WinStar folks got a hold of me and wanted me to start it back up, to keep it going. And they kept calling me and asking me to. And I had somebody give me a tape that they had recorded of John doing his speech at the press club, the National Press Club. And I listened to the tape, and as I listened to it, I kept thinking, well, wait a minute, this sounds like an argument John and I had years ago. And he said what I said verbatim, word for word. Maybe I should do something with WinStar, you know? And so I proceeded to try to start things back up and keep it going for a few years, because as I had printed on a sweatshirt and t-shirts, the job's not done.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You know, you were one of the early adapters of getting the WinStar material, I remember this clearly, to schools, to kids, through educators, and it was such an innovative way. Back in the day when WinStar started in 1976, John and Tom Crump, they put all those symposiums together with a lot of help from other people. It was a very worldwide event. You know, we had big names come in, and Aspen got overtaken for a week, and it was high-level stuff. But then you saw early on using technology in some ways to reach the younger generation, and I was so impressed with that.
Well, I was naturally, the technology, had it been there when John was doing it, he would have used it, but technology had come such a long way, and we were able to get online and literally communicate with people all over the world live while we were doing a symposium. And we actually had three of them in my tenure, and it was amazing because we'd get typed in messages asking questions of our guest commentators, and it was amazing. I'd get a question in from England, and I get a question in from Australia, and then I get a question in from Thailand, and it was literally amazing to me that we were able to do that. And of course, I had a lot of help also, as you said earlier about your, you know, knowing John's situation and all of ours. Anytime you try to do anything, it's never a one-person job. But I was thrilled that we were able to do that.
Hmm. You know, the response out of that too was interesting to me as well. I'd have to go dig through a bunch of cassette tapes because they still exist in my basement. I'd have to go dig through some cassette tapes, and I'm sure there's interviews that you and I did back then to promote this symposium and this really at the time groundbreaking way of using technology to reach people around the world when it comes to environmental challenges and things like that. So in the space of, let's say, just the last decade since you and I saw each other up at the Windstar property, and I think there was something small, you know, there was a gathering there. I remember speaking to a group there, and you and I were hanging out, and Terry was there. You know, I mean, it was a really great weekend. And I think about the last decade, how things climate-wise have, you know, taken a nosedive, depending on how you view all that. And I'm just wondering what you think, you know, how would, I know these are not fair questions, you know, but you got to give me a little latitude. You were closer to John than anybody. How do you think he'd be responding to what's going on in the world now, climate change and the denial of climate science and all the work that Windstar did to kind of change all that, the ripple effect from that? How do you think he'd be responding to all this?
Well, I think he would be doing pretty much the same thing that he did do that I kept arguing with him about, was speaking at his concerts. Every time he did a concert, he would communicate with the audience about the relevance of climate and what's going on with climate change and what we need to be doing and how every single person can help. Everybody that wants to, has a voice, can help. Nobody is left out of the equation, because everybody needs to be talking about this. If we put pressure on our senators and congressmen and all, they'll start paying more attention to it. And the same with the presidency. And worldwide, everybody needs to be speaking up and doing something. And John would be pushing that. He'd be standing on stage talking about it. He'd be doing things like the National Press Club. I mean, he was involved with World Hunger. Anything that relates to the planet and the people on it and the longevity of it, he would have been involved. He would have been speaking up.
In some ways, there's been some great changes. You know, if I go back to 1970, when the first Earth Day was instituted, and I don't think for one second that Richard Nixon was an environmentalist, but he wasn't stupid either. And when the Cuyahoga River in Ohio caught on fire and people were screaming out for change and marching in the streets, he created the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. And that agency has had major oversight over corporations, things like that, for decades. And in the last 5 years, for sure, there's been a lot of pushback on, you know, what corporations are allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. There's been many rollbacks on pre-presidential edicts that protect the public. And I'm always fascinated that it usually comes down to that. It's the profit versus people angle in just about everything when it comes to the environment. And I think one of the things I learned most attending Windstar and then, of course, speaking there, which was just a whole different deal, but attending there, I always started to get some sense that all is not lost, that in corners of the world, there are people doing incredible work. And I think when I listened to some of the work that you did, when you reached out around the world and had those virtual symposiums, Ron, you were doing virtual symposiums before there was anything virtual to do. You guys were way ahead of your time. I had that same sensibility. Do you feel all these years later, as you've picked up the mantle for John in so many ways and did that at Windstar, are you feeling hopeful despite the climate, no pun intended?
Well, I'm hopeful that with this upcoming election that we'll change the leadership, and that'll allow us to get a lot more accomplished in that area, as well as so many others. You talk about the EPA. I mean, they've pulled the plug on certain aspects of things going on with EPA that's keeping them from being able to really do their job in all areas and deal with those large corporations. Because if you let them run, they'll just do whatever they want. And like you said about the fire in the river, I mean, that was hard to miss. You know, there was no way somebody could say, "Oh, that's not happening." Look out the window.
Yeah.
But in this day and age, we need people to be paying attention to what the scientists say and then acting on it. And unfortunately, there's been a gap there for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hopeful it's going to change come November 3rd and then on January 20th, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
29th. 20th. Yeah. So yeah. I'm hopeful. And again, it gets back to everybody starting to pay attention and speak up. You know, we have a number of major issues we need to deal with in the world right now. And climate change is a biggie, because if we don't do something about it, then our grandchildren's grandchildren are going to be living in bubbles if they're able to live at all.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you were one of the few people, I think, left that, I mean, your folks are gone and you were with John the entirety of his life, and you get to see the arc of his career. And I'm wondering, as you're talking, of course, it's not hard to hear his voice and your voice and your voice and his voice. They're almost inextricably connected over so many different issues and yet different platforms, but same outcomes. And I'm wondering, as you think about it all these years later, you know, you guys grew up together and all the traveling you did as your dad was in the military, the Air Force, and all that went along with it. Could you have ever imagined the trajectory, the career that he was going to have? Was there any indicator early on when he got that guitar that at one point you ever thought he'd be the leading record seller in the world for a while?
No, I really didn't think of it at all. I remember when he first started playing that 18-string guitar that Randy Sparks had rebuilt for him, or built, I should say, because I've never been one. And John had such an art of finger picking. And he would play that 18-string guitar, and I wish I still had him. I had a cassette of John playing the 18-string, and you could hear the lead guitar, rhythm guitar, and the bass guitar all at the same time because of his masterful art of finger picking on that 18 string. And it was glorious. And so I knew something special was going on then, but no, not when we were younger. I didn't think of, you know, he's going to go out there and change the world and sell all these records and be a superstar. You know, he's just my brother. And I treated him that way our whole lives, which sometimes was good and sometimes wasn't so good. You know, he was running around and he was such a superstar that, you know, a lot of people were, I think the term is yes men. And so they don't keep you in reality. And I was there to do that, much to his chagrin.
Sometimes. Yeah, you were the counterbalance, the counterweight. Yeah.
Yep.
You know, one of the best albums I've ever heard, you know, to me, the standard was the 1975 Double Live Evening with John Denver, done back in the day with the full orchestra and the whole thing and the musicians. And it was a blowout Universal Amphitheater for over a week's time period. It was a wonderful thing and sold just an uncalculable amount of millions of albums. But in 2007, you and Roger Nichols, the late, great, immortal Roger Nichols, collaborated on a set of digitally mastered tapes that Roger captured when he and John and a few others went to the Soviet Union and did these private concerts first, and then eventually were able to do some public concerts. But he captured these, and to this day, I think it's the most incredible. I don't know how he did it. Sim C. Nichols works with me on a different program, and I talk with Connie a lot, Roger's widow, and she talks about how he built these things, these digital recorders, and they fit in suitcases in 1985, another thing ahead of his time. So when I heard that Live in the USSR CD, the pristine quality, John's voice, the guitar, and even the reaction of these Soviet audiences back at the time when the Cold War was still going on, when you guys put that together, I thought that's probably the best effort I've ever heard.
I think it was the single best exercise of John's vocal and guitar ability he ever recorded. And it came out of, I had a contemporary Christian artist that I was managing at one point, and I asked Roger to come up with a way to record him digitally, just vocal and guitar. And so Roger, being the genius that he was, came up with a way to do it with RDATs. And so then when this opportunity came for John to go to the Soviet Union, which of course in those days, and I think even today, you have to be invited to go in. You can't get in unless you're invited. And I asked Roger, I said, hey, why don't you take the gear and record the concerts? Hmm. Roger said, yeah, I could do that. So he did. And then after they came back, and of course, John was doing that to promote the United States and our belief, which we've maintained, I guess, since I was about 14, that everybody's the same. You take away the politics and the religion, and everybody on this planet's the same. Every grandfather wants his grandchild to have a better life. Every father wants his son to have a better life for his daughter. And it amazed me back then that that wasn't something that we focused on more. And John picked up on it. And John, you know, being the entertainer that he was, we decided that he needed to go out to other places, not just in the United States, but go out around the world and communicate with music, because it was such a tremendous way to communicate anyway. And after the Jimmy Carter episode in Iraq or Iran, it was, I don't remember, just a second, they canceled the cultural exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union. So John started working to try to reestablish that. And the first step was to be able to perform concerts open to the public in the Soviet Union. So John went over and he'd do a concert for two Politburo members, and he'd do another one on another trip, it'd be five Politburo members, and then two or three different concerts for two and three and four Politburo. Anyway, and they finally let us go over so John could do concerts open to the public. And it was such a success for us that it opened the door for American artists who hadn't been able to go into the Soviet Union since Jimmy Carter's scenario. And out of what we did, I mean, we had a meeting with Secretary of State George Shultz, I could tell you about, but that's another whole story.
Yeah.
But anyway, out of the Reagan and Gorbachev summit, the first summit that they had, if I remember correctly, the only thing that came out of that was they reestablished the cultural exchange. And that happened from Gorbachev's side, not Reagan's. And it became available, it was created and came out because of what John did, which nobody knows and has never been out. John would not let me put that in the press or anything or say anything about it in that regard, but he really was responsible for changing the attitude between the Russians and ourselves, and understanding that cultural exchange was the best way for our people and their people to start getting to know each other and getting to understand each other better. So Gorbachev initiated it, and the rest is history.
I got to tell you, I've heard you talk about this. We've discussed this on and off the air before, and I just, it's hard for me to picture, here we are in the 21st century, that seems like 100 years ago, that there was a time where, you know, the Soviet Union and the United States were like the main loggerheads, and now it's somewhat different. Then we talk now, China's in that slot to some degree. But John also went to China, and Simpson, yeah, was talking about his efforts, and he went to China. And there was some story you might know better about the Chinese premier coming to the States and John performing, and then the premier went backstage and wanted an album, and John thought he wanted one, but the guy wanted like 500. Do you ever heard this?
I have heard it, but I was not involved in that at that particular time.
Yeah.
But John, that was an extension of the plan.
Right.
It was to communicate, and John went to China and performed. And also, I mean, I loved it when I was watching the Olympics, the Summer Olympics over there, and I was watching a volleyball match. And when they took their break or halftime or whatever they call it, the entire crowd sang Country Roads.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm watching the TV and listening, and I'm like, oh, well, I'll be darned. You know, they're actually singing John's song. And it was amazing to me. But he had that kind of effect. And he also went to Vietnam. He went, you know, he started going everywhere. But it all started with him going to the Soviet Union. Mm. And then the success of that, you know, made it something else that we had to continue.
There's not many artists that I can think of that would, in some ways, because he did some of those things and spent so much time on Windstar-related activities and all those type of connections, that he actually put his own career at risk and had to take a back seat for a very long time because of that. And I've always wondered, you know, like one begat the other. You know, without that voice and without his prowess on the guitar and without his ability to sing the songs that he did, and then to basically, you know, hold people in the palm of his hands with the way he performed, he doesn't have the opportunity to do the other things that were important, and vice versa. And I always kind of felt like, you know, I know you take things as they come and you kind of go with the flow, but I think one of the last times I got a chance to talk with him, it was before I even was at Windstar. So even back in 1989, he was doing these, events called Higher Ground. And he went around it, right? And he would do these. I did 6-7 of these around the world. And he did one in Chicago. And I was part of the team. Now, he and I had already met a couple times, but we weren't connected like we were later. And he was coming to Chicago to do this event. And I called Bill Curtis, who at the time had just come in from New York as the evening anchor of the CBS News back to Chicago. And I called him and I said, hey, you know, John Denver's coming to town. It's not a concert, but it'd be great if you guys, we could get some press out of this. And I left him a voicemail, never heard back. The next night at the Chicago Theater, there's, you know, I think that whole place holds 5,000-7,000. I'm not really sure. It's 3/4 full. And I come walking in and here comes Bill Curtis down the same aisle. And that was in 1989. And that event, Higher Ground, brought Bill and I together. And we ended up, we still stay in touch. We did a couple of projects together. The best one was called Earth Matters. There was a series of 1-minute nationally syndicated messages that I researched and scripted, and Bill did with this voice that he has. And all of that came out of the night of Higher Ground. So every time I start looking at the things that I've done, I can trace it all back to Windstar somehow. And I think even though it's not what it used to be, it serves such a high purpose. And I'm sure I'm not the only person in the world that feels that way.
I still have a lot of people from Windstar that stay in touch. And, you know, John's interest in the environment started when he first went to Colorado. And I was in Vietnam at the time, and he'd gone up there and performed during the winter. He did it 2 years in a row, but that's where he fell in love with the mountains and the environment. And out of that experience is what created Windstar. And everything that he did about the environment came out of that first winter being in the Rocky Mountains. And it was a great thing. And, you know, he fought for the environment. I ran across the tape, the gal at Lucy Zell Adobe, the lady that owned it, Lucy, in L.A., best Mexican food in L.A., I think. And she gave me a cassette of John and Jackson Brown. And they were sitting in Lucy's contemplating getting a group of artists to do concerts about the environment and stopping the war and the war effort, and which they attempted to do at one point. And I don't remember, something got in the way of it happening, it was a good idea. And it was just amazing. I have people come up all the time, not in the last 9 months, but before, when I was out and about a lot, and they mentioned Windstar, they mentioned John and his interest in the environment and what he did about it. It's amazing. He was an environmentalist before there was a term.
You know, I think of that's such a great point, because it's always about what can you see. You know, they call people visionaries that can apparently see what other people cannot, and then they be somehow are ahead of their time. And for me, I think of how he wrote these songs decades ago that still stand up today. You know, go back to the Country Roads thing. You were instrumental in helping us secure the rights to use Country Roads in a different show that I do called The Bridge, that some people listen to in Washington and New York. And I found out in the putting together and production of that show that my co-host Hu Young in China told me that millions of young children learned to speak English by singing Country Roads. And I keep thinking about what it must be like for John and Bill and Taffy, who all collaborated on that song. There was no way to know the kind of impact that was going to have decades later. It's still moving around.
It's amazing to me. I actually heard that on your first show, because I listened in, as I do a lot, to listen to your stuff. And I was blown away. they used that song. And then I started thinking about, well, there's the Olympics, what I heard. And it was like, oh, gosh, amazing. But that gets back to what we talked about cultural exchange and music being a way to communicate.
Mm. And, you know, you've been in the music business yourself. One of my favorites CDs is the Surfaris. You produced that, right? Remember that one?
Yeah.
That's a great CD with all their hits. And so
I tell people don't listen to it when you're driving.
Yeah.
It's one of those.
Yeah.
It's a CD. It's all instrumental.
Yeah.
But as you drive, you start getting more and more, you know, kind of bouncing to the tune.
Oh, I know.
Moving your head to the beat, and and you're liable to catch yourself speeding.
No question. Attention. No question. So back to the music business part, the difficulty of music. I don't know what it's like now. I you know, it's a different ballgame, but the difficulty of rising up from a kid that got an 18-string guitar from Randy Sparks to becoming literally, for a time, the best-selling recording artist in the world and staying as one of the top five artists in the world for many, many years, that kind of success is rare. I have friends of mine that perform, and they live to perform, and they're on the road constantly performing or doing virtual stuff now. And, you know, there's very few breakthrough artists. You know, you could probably name 50 that have become really iconic in the last 100 years, and the rest, everybody kind of falls in underneath. And I'm talking about solo artists. So from your perspective, right, being in the business and being around the business, you look at the difficulty of all that taking place, right things had to happen, the right puzzle pieces falling in line. Do you think that it's far more different to become a success of John's stature and magnitude now than it was then, or is it easier?
No, it's definitely harder. And the biggest part is breaking into the business, I think. But one of the things, you know, that John was one of, I always think of maybe 4 or 5 entertainers in the world that can literally stand on a stage with their instrument and entertain 25,000 people or more. And it's an amazing ability to be blessed in that way that you can do that. And, you know, John, Elton John, there's just a handful. And I think that was one of the things that made it possible for John to do as much as he did, because he could go out with his guitar, and it didn't matter if it was 6 people around the campfire or 25,000. Or I think he did the Moody Blues. He opened for the Moody Blues one time in that giant stadium in England, uh-huh, London. I can't think of the name right now. But, yeah, and, you know, that was one of the things that made him special, was that he could do that. He could communicate on that level with that many people, just he and himself. He didn't have to have a group or a bunch of backup, although it was wonderful when he did. But, mm-hmm, amazing.
23 years have passed. I know that none of this gets any easier for you, but I have to tell you that you sound more measured than I've ever heard you talk about your brother. I don't know if it's just time or I have no idea, but I hesitate doing these conversations with you at all. I'd rather just, as I said, we just talk about sports or some other crap that nobody gives a shit about. But there is a tie into something that was very important in my life. And I, you know, I do whatever I can because of him, meaning there's only a handful of people in my life, 3 or 4 really, that I could pinpoint to them and say, these people are part of the reason I am who I am. And John's one of those. So I always feel, whether I'm doing this show or The Bridge or working on a book project, or whatever it is, there's somehow a tie back to this idea that was born out of his music, born out of Windstar, and the whole concept of, you know, if not me, who, and if not now, when, probably to the point of irritating other people, because I'm like, look, we got stuff to do here. Most people don't ask those questions, but as you think about the arc of his career and your relationship together and how you stepped in to do things with Windstar, how do you see your kind of common legacy with John, with the work?
Well, I hope that I helped and contributed and did something to make it work, if you will. That's one of the things I always try to do, is make things work and solve problems. But it's you know, and you talk about thinking back. I have people that I'll run into, or even on some of these exchanges like Facebook, that contact me and tell me stories about how they first listened to John when they were little and their parents played his music. And then as they grew up and learned more about him, that it started changing the way they thought. Hmm. And they started changing the way their life went. And it amazes me, you know, just amazes me.
Came looking for the answers to some questions on his mind, seeking truth and understanding in the hope that he would find a way to better serve his brothers and his sisters in the sun. sharing all that he was given, giving all to everyone. Come and listen to the story of a journey once begun, of a people and their plenty and their season in the sun, and how they gave themselves to symbols and things that they could hold, living lives in desperation in the fear of letting go. It amazes me, and I know the wind will surely someday blow it all away. It amazes me, and I'm so very grateful that you made the world this way. For our paths have come together now, where do we go from here? Will our differences divide us? Must we always live in fear? For there are things that we must move through, some things to cast aside. But our Father watches over us, our Mother will provide. It amazes me, and I know the wind will someday surely blow it all away. It amazes me.
Really glad to spend a little bit of time with Ron Dutchendorf. This has been extremely difficult for him. He is last man standing to some degree with the Dutchendorf family. John's brother, his mom Irma's gone. Of course, his dad's been gone for a long time. John's been gone. So Ron is the guy who kind of props all that stuff up. He's a really good guy, and I appreciate him taking the time out to add to this podcast. I didn't want to turn this into something sad, because while it is bittersweet, there is great cause for celebration. For me, the music has always been paramount and important, but the work that John left undone, as I mentioned when I opened this podcast, that's always been more important to me. The music, I think, was a means to an end for him. He was given this incredible voice, amazing talent on the guitar that I don't think he ever got much credit for. At one point, he was the leading record-selling artist in the world for a while, and he still remains as one of the top 10 solo artists of all time, long after he's gone. That's the musical part. But the other part, the Windstar part, and the work he did with the Cousteau Foundation, and the Hunger Project, and on, I realized that he was using music to make a difference, and he was able to make a difference because of his music. So I would be remiss if I didn't include at least a couple more songs that really have meant a lot to me over the years. But after Sweet Surrender, I did go back and resurrect the Rocky Mountain High thing, and interesting, I would, this is back in vinyl days, no digital, no nothing, and I would have that song, you know, on the Rocky Mountain High LP and constant airplay in my bedroom. And at one point, my mom surprised me. I came home from school, probably 1974, 75, somewhere in there, and she had turned my bedroom into a log cabin in the mountains. It was so great. So we lived right near the Kennedy Expressway in Chicago. If I opened my windows, I could hear the traffic every night. There's not a lot to do with, you know, eagles and mountains and things in that part of the city at all. But my mom went out and got one of those big wall murals that were so popular back in the day, and it was the side of a mountain. And she put it on my wall that covered the whole thing. And she had refurbished and restained and revarnished my bed frame. And it was like an old wooden thing. And the same thing with my dresser. And it was just, and I had this lamp in the room that looked like something that belonged in a cabin. It was already there. And I walked in that day and I just thought this was the coolest thing ever. So years later, when I went and spoke in Aspen in 1994, my mom took full credit for somehow being part of that because of her redecorating my bedroom.
He was born in the summer of his 27th year, coming home to a place he'd never been before. Left yesterday behind him, you might say he was born again. Might say he found a key for every door. When he first came to the mountains, his life was far away, on the road and hanging by a song. But the string's already broken, and he doesn't really care. Keeps changing fast, it don't last for long. But the Colorado Rocky Mountain High, I've seen it rain and fire and sky. The shadow from the starlight is softer than a lullaby. Rocky Mountain High, Rocky Mountain High. He climbed Cathedral Mountain, saw silver clouds below, saw everything as far as you can see. And they say that he got crazy once and tried to touch the sun, and he lost a friend but kept his memory. Now he walks in quiet solitude, the forests and the streams, seeking grace in every step he takes. His side has turned inside himself to try and understand the serenity of a clear blue mountain lake. And the Colorado Rocky Mountain High, I've seen it rain and fire in the sky. You can talk to God and listen to the casual reply. Rocky Mountain High, Rocky Mountain High. Now his life is full of wonder, but his heart still knows some fear of a simple thing he cannot comprehend. Why they try to tear the mountains down to bring in a couple more, more people, more scars upon the land. The Colorado Rocky Mountain High, I've seen it rain and fire and sky. I know he'd be a poor man if he never saw an eagle fly. Rocky Mountain High, it's the Colorado Rocky Mountain High, I've seen it rain and fire in the sky. Friends around a campfire, everybody's high. Rocky Mountain High, Rocky Mountain High, Rocky Mountain High, Rocky Mountain High.
I could play dozens of songs, and it was very difficult for me to some, you know, I got songs I could put here in no particular order that all mean so much to me. But when John would finish concerts with Calypso, I literally remember one time at the Chicago Theater, there was an event called Higher Ground. I referenced it earlier when I was talking with Ron Dutchendorf. Bill Curtis and I became friends there. We've been friends since then. We've done a lot of projects together. And at that event at Higher Ground, he sang two or three songs, and one of them was Calypso, but he did it a cappella. And I couldn't find any a cappella versions of Calypso. The closest I could get was a concert he did in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, many, many years ago. And it was just John and this 12-string guitar. You know, you heard Ron earlier talk about an 18-string guitar. I mean, I don't even know how you would tune that. But when John pulled out that 12-string, he made it sound like 24 guitars. It was phenomenal to me, the ability he had on the guitar. And, of course, his voice is without question. So I want to thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this. if there's nothing else that you take away, the music, of course, is great. But that whole thought of if not you, who? And if not now, when do we start to move towards a little bit different way of seeing the world? Until next time, safe travels. Adios.
To sail on a dream, on a crystal clear ocean, to ride on the crest of a wild raging storm, to work in the service of life and the living, in search of the answers to questions unknown, to be part of the movement and part of the growing, part of beginning to understand. You've been to things that you show us, the stories you tell. I Calypso, I sing to your spirit, the men who have served you so long and so well. Put a lady, put a lady, put a lady, put a like the dolphin who guides you, you bring us beside you to light up the darkness and show us the way. For though we are strangers in your silent world, to live on the land we must learn from the sea. To be true as the tide and free as a windswell, joyful and loving in letting it be.